From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Biotech as a hobby? The Baltimore Underground Science Space, known as BUGS, welcomes amateurs and experts to experiment at its laboratory and dive into classes on DNA, gene editing, and microbes. We speak to Executive Director Dr. Lisa Shifley, and two local high school students describe their efforts at BUGS to design a blood-clotting bandage that could save lives of gunshot victims. Zion Smith of Baltimore City College describes the goal.
For the public to have access to a kit with this product, and so they can apply the gel foam to a wound on one of the extremities and be able to help clot the blood before somebody bleeds out.
Plus, growing Baltimore's tree canopy. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Most of the time, when people take up a hobby, they sign up for music lessons or buy crafting supplies or join a local wood shop or gym. Not at BUGS, the Baltimore Underground Science Space. BUGS offers a unique alternative, classes and laboratory space for amateurs and experts to investigate biotechnology. Don't worry if you failed high school biology, there are no pop quizzes at BUGS. Instead, you can learn how to genetically modify yeast or create art with microbes. Dr. Lisa Shifley is the executive director of BUGS. She's also an assistant professor of molecular biology and genomics at Loyola University, Maryland. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Sheila.
Tell us about the laboratory. What types of equipment does it have?
Well, so BUGS is actually a fully functional scientific laboratory. So it's the same types of equipment you would find at a major research institution. Slightly more limited. The equipment is a little bit more gently used. But it's fully functional to conduct all kinds of basic investigations and all types of basic experiments in biotechnology.
How does there come to be a BUGS?
In about 2012, there was a science competition, an international science competition, that was geared towards college students. And my co-founder, Thomas Burkett, who's the chair of our board of directors, he was leading a team for this competition. And what he found was that lots of people who weren't directly affiliated with a college wanted to participate. And they started joining the team, but there was really no mechanism for them to be part of a team because they were outside of all traditional academic structures. And so as that group developed and worked together over the summer, we really began to think about, you know, should there be a place for lay people who are interested in science to come in and to learn more and to be able to explore for themselves?
And I mentioned that BUGS is both for experts and amateurs. How do these different groups use the lab?
So they use it very much collaboratively. That's really what we're about, is bringing diverse people together and getting them to work as a group, as a unit. So we have lots of professional scientists from the local universities and medical schools, and they come in very often to teach, to give seminars, to interact with people, and to learn how to communicate directly to the public. Some of them are also budding entrepreneurs, so they might have an idea for a little side project that they want to try out. And so we offer them a space to be able to come in and to try some initial experiments and see how things work.
It seems like, I mean, the other kinds of hobbies that I mentioned,
right,
are not potentially life and death.
Oh, nothing's skills. Life and death at BUGS, no.
Nothing's life and death.
Nothing's life and death. It's very safe. In fact, we hold ourselves to very, very high standards. So we're what is called a community lab, and we really stress the community aspect of it. This isn't people in their garage or in their backyard doing this kind of biohacking and seeing where things can go. We kind of demand that everybody who uses our space is very open about what they're doing, that if they're going to start a new project, they have to give us a full description. We have a safety committee, and we really watch one another and work collaboratively to make sure that we're all safe. And we're very tightly regulated in terms of what comes into the lab and what goes out of the lab.
What are some of the popular workshops and classes that Bugs offers?
So just this past week, we had a two-week class that we called Food Forensics. So this had to do with proper labeling of the food that we eat. So you might know that fish is one of the foods that's very often mislabeled. You might think you're paying $21.99 a pound for some very great Chilean sea bass, and it's not Chilean sea bass at all. So we had a course where people could bring in a sample of fish, and we would grind it up and take out the DNA, and we would sequence that DNA and check what species it actually was. And that was for people who had never been in a lab before. And in 2 weeks, they learned how to do all of these very complicated, actually, scientific procedures and find out how authentic their food was.
Give me another example.
So we have a class coming up in a couple weeks at the end of November where people are actually going to look at themselves and their own genetics. So there is very good research from the past couple of years that serotonin, right, is one of these neurotransmitters in our brain, and it's detected by something called the serotonin receptor. And there's different variants of that receptor. And people with those different variants can have different behaviors and different moods. And so people are going to be able to actually come into the lab, sample their own DNA. So just from their saliva, you're going to spit into a tube. There's lots of your cheek cells in there. You'll be able to take the cells out, look at the DNA, and see which version of the serotonin receptor you actually have. And we'll talk about what does that mean? Does that really predict your behavior? And how should we react to that type of information?
So interesting. You also have clubs and classes for young people.
Right. So we originally started off thinking we would be mostly for adults. And what we found is that first we'd get a couple teenagers who would attend our classes. And then just more and more, we got such a strong demand from teenagers and now from middle school students. So we have an iGEM team. So it's a team that participates in the International Genetically Engineered Machines competition. And this is a group of high schoolers that meets every Saturday all summer from May to October. And they design and carry out their own biotechnology project.
We're going to get a chance to meet a couple of them in a minute. Right now, we're talking to Dr. Lisa Scheifele, Executive Director of BUGS, the Baltimore Underground Science Space, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. I want to pull into this conversation two high school students who use the lab at BUGS. Zion Smith is a senior at Baltimore City College. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
And Mercedes Ferrandez is a senior at Bard High School Early College. Welcome.
Thank you.
You are both part of the Merit Leadership Academy, a nonprofit that supports Baltimore students who aspire to careers in medicine, and you are part of the BUGS program, Baltimore Bio Crew. I understand you're working on a project for the International Genetically Engineered Machines Competition. Zion, what's the project?
Yeah, so this year we decided that we wanted to really focus on some of the problems that affect our community here in Baltimore City. So we basically directed our project towards the properties of blood clots and the ways that we can possibly enhance certain properties to help solve issues in our city. So this year we're going to be, or we are developing a project where we are going to not only make clots and use a specific enzyme out of the
Russell's viper venom.
Yes, right. Russell viper
is a kind of snake.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and we're able to isolate an enzyme from this snake that enhances and accelerates blood clotting in the body, and this can be used for people who are suffering from gunshot or stab wounds and are bleeding out.
So you're finding a way to effectively, economically, mm-hmm. treat blood so it will clot faster.
Exactly.
At the point of a gunshot wound.
Yes. So we plan to design this product that has this specific enzyme embedded within a bandage or a gel foam and allows for the public to have access to a kit with this product. And so they can apply the gel foam to, you know, a wound on one of the extremities and be able to help clot the blood before somebody bleeds out.
And Mercedes, there's another aspect to the research, right, that has to do with busting clots.
Yeah. So there's also the clot breaking team. So we want to use TPA to...
TPA is this enzyme?
Yes, yeah, a tissue plasminogen activator. Right now, there's TPA on the market. A lot of hospitals use it for patients with stroke and heart disease to break up clots. But we wanted to have a more cost-effective version of TPA and cut down the sequence of TPA so it's more concentrated. So hopefully it will perform better for those patients with clotting diseases.
Lisa, how does bugs help guide the students through this process?
I think that's really the key word is guide. What I'm always so impressed with is how these students who didn't know each other at all before, who come from very different backgrounds and very different ages, we have students from 9th to 12th grades, how well they over time start to mesh into a team. So that's really what we do is we give them the structures to work together. We start putting them together into smaller groups to get to know one another. We see who wants to take a leadership role. We see what aspect of the project excites them most. Some students absolutely love being at the lab bench. Some students love thinking about the ethical aspects. Some students love thinking about the medical aspects. So we really let them all find their niche and follow their passion. And our job is to kind of reform them into teams to make sure everything's getting done and to help show them what's possible.
What is it like to use the laboratory at Bugs? I mean, what has these projects, what do they teach you about the scientific process?
I think as a Baltimore City Public High School student, you really don't get much lab experience. So when I first stepped into Bugs last year, I was really surprised at how it actually looked. I expected a lab bench, but I didn't expect, mm-hmm. Most people when we think of pipettes, we think of the little bulbs, the plastic bulbs that you kind of squeeze at the top.
Because that's what you have in school labs.
Right. But the pipettes, you can have specific amounts you can take up. So it's microliters. I didn't know that was a thing. Mm-hmm. Also just seeing a microcentrifuge was basically a machine that spins really fast. It was just really cool seeing all the different types of lab tools you can use. And then just understanding the actual cellular processes that was happening. Because before I stepped into a lab, I didn't know what was really going on in the cell. I just knew the basics from what I learned in high school.
Yeah, so in our first year, we were actually being taught by senior Baltimore BioCrew students, and they were teaching us gel electrophoresis and polymerase chain reaction and how to isolate DNA and, doing a lot of different things in the lab. But this year, we've grown a lot, and we were able to teach the newcomers how to do those same exact protocols because we've gotten such a great understanding of these basic lab techniques.
You sound like it's turned you into a scientist.
Yes, I've really grown to love research a lot, and I really like how research, and especially synthetic biology, allows you to kind of find what problem do you want to solve in the world today.
Thank you so much, all of you, for this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Zion Smith and Mercedes Ferrandez are high school seniors and members of the Baltimore BioCrew. Dr. Lisa Shifley is the executive director of Bugs, the Baltimore Underground Science Space. The crew is fundraising to go to the iGEM competition in Boston at the end of the month. We'll link to its GoFundMe page. I'm Sheila Cass. Quick break now, and when we're back, planting a tree to last a lifetime.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Little Gem Magnolia, Scarlet Oak, Slippery Elm. These native trees of Baltimore shade lawns, filter air, feed critters, and provide shelter for birds and squirrels, all while adding to the city's tree canopy. The goal is to reach a canopy of 40% by 2037. Joining us to talk about why the canopy is important is Charles Murphy, manager of Tree Baltimore, a city program within the Urban Forestry Division of the Department of Recreation and Parks. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What is the tree canopy?
The tree canopy is basically looking at the city with a bird's eye view, and whatever is covered by tree branches or leaves is part of the urban tree canopy.
So it's a geographical description.
I mean, exactly, it's basically the coverage of the city, and so the benefits from shade and things like that that the tree provides to the city.
Okay, so you said a bird's eye view, and you're not a bird. So how do you measure it?
Yeah, we have different techniques using aerial photography and something called LIDAR that shoots radar from airplanes passing over down to the earth, and anything that bounces off from the leaves of the tree actually show a different sign of radar back into the photographs that we then analyze, or we actually work with the U.S. Forest Service to analyze.
So it's a pretty precise measurement.
Oh, absolutely, down to the meter.
How is Baltimore's canopy doing?
Excellent, actually. We are one of the only cities in the country to actually increase in tree canopy over the time span of 2007 to 2015. As I said, we partnered with the U.S. Forest Service to really do the analysis, and they actually had to run the numbers three times before they were convinced that we actually had an increase in tree canopy from 27 to 28%.
They were that surprised?
Yeah.
Have you figured out why? What's going on in Baltimore that makes it a positive change instead of a negative one recently?
So we're currently figuring that out. So the analysis was just an overall picture of Baltimore. And so they're diving in a bit more into where did we actually lose canopy? Because we did lose canopy. We lost about 3%, but we gained 4%. So looking at why did we lose that 3%? So developments, storm damage, and things like that. And then where was the growth? So we've been doing tree plantings for the last 15 to 20 years. In the last 10 years, we've really ramped up numbers. The very early trees from, say, years 1 to 3 in that 10-year span are actually showing up on radar now. So anything we've planted in the last 7 years has not. So we're trying to figure out where the new plantings are actually showing up and potentially where the growth of natural forest is. So a tree doesn't stop growing. So this canopy is continually growing on these larger trees. So it's looking at forest edge as well as the street tree and park plantings that we just started doing in the last 10 years.
Well, as I understand it, the age of the trees in Baltimore is something of a weakness in the canopy. Explain that.
Yeah, so there have been many studies that the average age of a urban tree is very, very low. That's just tied to urban stressors, whether it's just living on a street where most trees are used to living in a forest land. So any tree planted downtown that only survives a couple of years really bring down the numbers. But if you look at the actual spread of age, especially if you go into some of our parks like Druid Hill and Gwent Falls, Leakin Park, some of those trees are hundreds of years old. So it's difficult to compare, say, a forest setting where all trees have a decent chance of survival to an urban area where a large percentage of all the street trees are going to have a much more difficult time surviving.
So there's kind of an age gap.
There is, absolutely.
In the average age, there aren't many middle-aged trees in Baltimore.
Correct. So in our parklands, we have a lot of old trees, and then we have a lot of newly planted trees in that last 10 to 20 years that I brought up earlier. But that gap between, say, a 25 and 50-year-old tree is really going to start to hinder us. So if you go into parks like Druid Hill Park, you'll see a very large overstory, and that's great.
What is an overstory?
So there are three different classes of tree canopy. So there's overstory, which is those very large trees that you're walking under, and you can barely even notice that you're under a tree because it's so far up. And then there's the understory, which is these smaller young trees that are used to growing in the shade and don't provide a ton of canopy, but are nice to fill in, especially like under power lines and things like that. And then there's a midstory. In a forest setting, when you look up, you are seeing branches and leaves all the way up to the top of the tree canopy. That midstory is what's filling in that gap. And we don't really have a large midstory, especially in our developed parkland area. So you'll walk out and you'll see small newly planted trees, and then you'll see trees that are 50 to 60 feet tall, but there's nothing in between. So we're really working to offset that.
That's Charles Murphy, manager of Tree Baltimore, an initiative of the city's urban forestry program, here on The Record. I'm Sheila Cast. What are the factors that contribute to the loss of the canopy?
So I mentioned some of the bigger ones tied to development as well as storm damage. So anytime hurricanes come through or tropical storms, they're really causing a decent amount of damage. And one thing that we can't even capture via numbers like trees coming down, we can capture trees that come down on public right-of-way like the streets or in parklands because urban forestry is responsible for removal. We are not responsible for stuff on private property. So when a storm comes through, all the trees that come down on private property, we have no clue of the numbers because we just aren't responsible for those.
But the next time you do a survey,
so, yes,
so
we
not
have
there.
To wait the 7 to 10 years where we get the Forest Service to help with our analysis of that. But yeah, so that's a very difficult thing for us to figure out. But so storm damage is a huge one, but development is another big one. And figuring out, and we work with a lot of the planners, especially city planners, to make sure that we're minimizing the trees being removed for each individual project. But when it goes onto private property, that's when then the issues start to arise.
What about pests?
We lost a large percentage of trees a couple of years ago to the emerald ash borer. At this point, it's here. It's a bug from Asia that got transported into Michigan and has made its way to Maryland and now through Baltimore. So every ash tree that is not being treated will presumably be dead in the next 3 to 4 years. Luckily, urban forestry has worked on a program to get additional funding, and we are treating about 400 of the largest specimen trees on public land. And all the ones that we are not, we got funding to start removing them before they become extremely hazardous. And we are removing and replanting with a more adequate species.
Is fall the best time to plant trees?
So the quote goes, 20 years ago was the best time to plant trees. Today is the next best. So yeah, fall and spring are two super busy seasons because the weather is appropriate. Winter, when the ground is frozen, isn't great. And when it's a drought season like summer, it's not ideal. So we tend to focus in the fall and in the springtime for our tree plantings and giveaways.
Tree Baltimore holds workshops about how to properly plant a tree. What's the most basic advice? What is it that people often get wrong, that the basic advice you give people?
When it comes to a tree, picking the right tree is always ideal. So talking to the person that you're either buying the tree from, or if you're getting the tree from us, just spending a couple of minutes talking. We are tree people. We love to talk about it. So getting that advice and getting the right tree. And then they always say to dig an appropriate hole when you're planting your tree. So making sure that when you're looking at the root ball of the tree, which is basically either in a container, which we typically give them out in, or we have something called a bald and burlap, which sack that's around the root ball. But that set of roots tied into soil, we want to go the same depth or a little higher or a little slower than that. And we want to go twice as wide. So we want to allow loose soil so the roots can grow out. Most people think that roots grow down and can cause a lot of issues like getting into your pipes and things, but that's actually not very true. Most roots are going outward. So we want to loosen the soil about twice as wide as that root ball, and then make sure that once the tree is finally planted, that you can see the root flare, which is kind of like if the tree was kind of wearing a skirt, it kind of kicks out at the bottom, that is being shown above the soil line so that it's not buried.
So it's more wide than deep is the thinking.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
There are lots of Tree Baltimore events coming up, including two tree plantings this Saturday in Overly and Canton, and a tree giveaway at Herring Run Nursery on Sunday from 9 a.m. to noon. How can people register for these events?
If they go to treebaltimore.org, we have an events page. And so Tree Baltimore is really a massive partnership within the city. So we're a city program, but we partner with a lot of different nonprofits like Blue Water Baltimore, Baltimore Tree Trust, and a bunch of different neighborhood communities. So the Canton planting is actually being run by individuals in Canton. And so we are providing the trees and resources and permits and getting them approval for everything. But they're really doing the on-the-ground work. So if you go to treebaltimore.org, you can find out about all these events, and you'll actually be registering with the individual groups that are setting up and doing the on-the-day events.
Thanks for telling us about it.
Thanks for having me.
Charles Murphy manages Tree Baltimore, part of the Baltimore City Department of Recreation and Parks. We'll link to their site as well as their coming events at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.